This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his course on the Book of Revelation. This is lecture number 29 on Revelation chapter 21, The Bride, New Jerusalem, continued.
So we've been looking at the New Jerusalem as part of the final climactic section of John's vision. And I suggested that one way to look at it, actually two things to note. First of all, it's important to realize that John sees, despite the detailed description of the city, John, I think, sees it primarily as symbolic for the people themselves. And not that there will not be a literal physical city in the new creation or cities. That's not John's purpose or his point. He seems to use, like other New Testament authors, use building or temple imagery to refer to the people themselves. And I think that's what John is doing here. The second thing is one way to divide chapter 21, starting with verse 9, is John seems to describe, first of all, the architectural features of the city, such as its makeup and the different parts of it as far as foundations and gates, and then the also the measurements of it as well. And then starting with verse 22 to the end of 21, we'll see that John focuses on who is there or who inhabits the New Jerusalem. In one sense, he's already telling us that. It's the people of God who are the building stones and who make up the temple. But more specifically, John will tell us, starting with verse 22, who inhabits the New Jerusalem temple. And we've already noted, too, that John seems to be merging another number of images to symbolically portray the end-time, final, consummated people of God. One of them is a bride language, the other is city language, but also temple language. And already, and we'll see that in more detail, in preparation for something that becomes more clear in 22, 1 through 5, John also portrays the new creation and the new Jerusalem temple as the Garden of Eden, a return to paradise or the restoration and renewal of paradise from Genesis chapter 1 and 2. But to then return to a handful of features regarding the New Jerusalem as far as its makeup is the measurement of the city, which comes once more out of Ezekiel and probably Zechariah 2 as well, because in Zechariah 2, the city is measured, as we said before, whereas in Ezekiel 40 through 48, which is the primary model John uses, the city, the temple itself is measured, but that's John's point. He wants to portray the whole city as a temple and not have a separate temple in it, as we'll see in a moment as well. John draws on Ezekiel's measuring imagery. We saw back in chapter 11 and the first two verses that John drew on Ezekiel 40 through 48 to describe the measuring of a temple, which probably there as well, the temple signified the people of God that were both preserved and protected, yet part of the temple was not measured and thrown out to the Gentiles, indicating that the church would still suffer persecution. Now John also sees the temple measured, and the question is, what does the measuring signify here? Probably two ideas. One of them is that this was the case back in chapter 11, the measuring there signified protection and preservation, and probably it does here as well. But it's not necessary to signify preservation in terms of protection from enemies or something like that, but simply to symbolically portray the eternal preservation and the eternal security of the people of God in the new creation. But second, the other feature of measuring is, I think, to demonstrate the extent and the magnitude of the people, of this city people, the magnitude of the consummated people of God themselves. So the measurement is not meant to portray an architectural blueprint that somehow we should imagine or think of a literal city and then be able to speculate as far as how many people might be there and how many people might actually live in the New Jerusalem in the future. No, the measurements are symbolically meant to portray both the security of God's people for eternity as well as the magnitude and the extent of the end time people of God that enter the new creation. Along with this, note the dimensions of the New Jerusalem, which once more, I would argue, does not signify a literal architectural blueprint of what the city is supposed to look like. We've suggested already that the city probably symbolizes the people of God. Back in verses 9 and 10, John heard that he was going to see the bride Jerusalem. What he saw and what he has shown here and described as a city. So the city symbolizes the people of God. That is further supported by the measurements of the city. Notice that all the measurements that you read here, the city itself, its breadth and length and width, which we said alludes to the Holy of Holies, which so the whole city is a giant cube-shaped Holy of Holies. It's square in the shape of the temple and other features in Ezekiel's chapter 40 through 48, Ezekiel's vision of the end-time temple. But now John's measurements note that they are, first of all, 12,000 stadia. So the length and breadth and width is 12,000 stadia. And then the wall is 144 cubits. It's not clear whether that's the height of the wall. Most translations translate the thickness of the wall. In either case, we'll see that's rather interesting that the wall would seem to be out of proportion to the size of the city if you're trying to make visual sense of it. But what I want to focus on for the moment is the numbers. Note that both of these numbers, the only ones mentioned in the text, are multiples of 12. So the first one, 12,000, would simply be 12 times 1,000. That is, 1,000 being a large round number, now times 12 brings 12,000. 12 then being a symbol of the people of God themselves, the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 apostles. So 12,000 is another way of saying here is the magnitude of and the complete people of God in the eschatological consummation. Here are the consummated people of God symbolized by the number 12, times 1,000, bringing about a large number. But even 144 cubits, whether it's the thickness or height of the wall, 144 being the 12 times 12. So the author's working with the number 12, not to indicate some architectural dimensions of exactly what the city will look like, but the number 12 is signifying the people of God. Now he works with that number to demonstrate the secure, consummated people of God in all their glory and all their magnitude now entering the new creation. And by the way, note too the measurements in stadia and cubits. A stadia was roughly 200 yards or so, and so the city is in visual or even literal dimensions, it would be about roughly 1,500 miles high and wide, etc. Also, a cubit, which is the measurement you find in Ezekiel 40 and through 48, the measurement being used for the temple, a cubit was about 18 to 20 inches long. So the author simply using common measurements from his day. But the city being the huge size of the city being roughly 1,500 miles high and wide and long, etc., suggests, I think, once more, the symbolic nature of this vision that the author is not envisioning a literal city, but the perfected, consummated people of God themselves who now enter the new creation, and that's symbolized by the huge number, the huge dimension of the city, but also the number 12. And the fact that back in 9, he's already identified the bride, which is the people, with the city itself. So the whole city then, the entire city is a, the entire city people, you might say, is a holy temple where God dwells. And John has taken Ezekiel 40 through 47, especially 48 in Ezekiel does see the city, but in 40 through 47, his vision is occupied with the restored end time temple. Now John takes all that temple imagery and applies it to the entire city to indicate that the city is a holy temple where God dwells. Another way of looking at it is even in Ezekiel 40 through 48, but also in the Exodus story, the very intention of God bringing his people out of Egypt through the Red Sea, through the wilderness, was so that he could dwell with them in a tabernacle and eventually a temple. So the whole idea of bringing them out of Egypt is that he would be their God, they would be his people, and he would dwell in their midst in a tabernacle. So now we see the goal of the Exodus finally reached with God dwelling in his temple people in Revelation 21 and 22 as well. One other feature that we highlighted very briefly, but is the fact that the whole city is made of gold. And even the measuring rod to measure it is made of gold, which is fitting to measure a city that is made primarily of gold. There are probably two ideas lying behind this. One of them, I think, is clear. The other, a little bit more subtle, perhaps, though other places in 21 and 22 make this connection more clear, especially 22, 1 through 5. And that is, first of all, the clear indication, I think, is that by portraying the city as gold, the entire city as made of gold, the author is portraying it as a temple or tabernacle from the Old Testament. That is, when you go back to Exodus and read the account of the building of the tabernacle, go to 1 Kings 5 through 7 and read the account of the building of Solomon's temple, gold was a significant metal that was used in the construction of the temple. Everything was made of gold, or everything was overlaid with gold. So by portraying the temple as gold, once more, this is not a literal architectural feature. The author wants to portray the New Jerusalem as a temple, as holy space, as a holy dwelling of God with his people. But furthermore, more subtly, the gold here may also recall the gold that was found in the Garden of Eden. If you go back to Genesis chapter 2, and by the way, there are a couple of other texts, other Jewish texts, apocalyptic texts, that make this connection between gold and the Garden of Eden. But back in chapter 2, where we find a description of the garden, I'll begin with verse 8. Now, the Lord God had planted a garden in the east, in Eden, and there he put man he had formed. And the Lord God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. In the middle of the tree, in the middle of the garden were the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. We'll come back to that text in a moment later. A river watering the garden flowed from Eden, and we'll look at image as well in chapter 22 of Revelation. From there, it separated into four headwaters. The name of the first is Pishon. It winds through the entire land of Havilah, where there is gold. And notice, the gold of that land is good. Aromatic resin and onyx are also there. So Havilah, in association with the river that comes out of the garden, is now associated with gold and other precious jewels. So at one level, both the precious jewels but also the gold would be one way of John presenting, or one way of John portraying, the city temple as also restored Eden, as also the Garden of Eden. And this will get developed in even more detail, and actually a little bit in the next section, but in 22:1-5, the connections with the Garden of Eden are unmistakable. But the next section I want to look at, the final section of the description of the makeup of the city, the construction of the city, its features, and its measurement, is found in verses 19 through 20. And actually, at this point, we stopped reading at verse 18, so I want to pick up with verse 19 and read to the end of chapter 21. So beginning with verse 19, the foundations of the city walls, which were mentioned back in verse 14, the foundations of the city walls were decorated with every kind of precious stone. The first foundation was jasper, the second sapphire, the third chalcedony, the fourth emerald, the fifth sardonyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. The 12 gates were 12 pearls, each gate made of a single pearl. The great seat of the street of the city was of pure gold, like transparent glass. I did not see a temple in the city, because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are its temple. The city does not need the sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of the Lord gives it light, and the Lamb is its lamp. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. On no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night there. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. Nothing impure will ever enter it, nor will anyone who does what is shameful or deceitful, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Now here foundation stones are enumerated and described and identified in detail. We were introduced to the foundations back in verse 14, where they were identified with the 12 apostles. Now the foundations / apostles are further identified with 12 stones. And so I take it that primarily the stones then represent the apostles or symbolize the apostles who form the bedrock or the foundation of the New Jerusalem. Again, symbolizing that this is the consummated people of God built on the apostles of the Lamb, Jesus Christ. This is a city that centers around the person of Jesus Christ, a multinational city that is built on the apostles of the Lamb, that is the church of Jesus Christ. Now, the question is, why does John go to such length to describe the foundations, the foundation apostles? Why does he go to such length to enumerate the stones that belong to or make up the 12 foundations? What do the 12 stones represent or suggest? And I would suggest to you that there are a handful of ideas that are plausible, and there's really no need to think that John only intends one of these. It's possible that, and I think very likely, that John is using an image that resonated with more than one idea, that brought with it, we'll see that John is using an image that carries with it a number of associations in its use in the Old Testament and other Jewish literature and apocalyptic literature as well. First of all, the most obvious one, I think, is the stones represent simply the beauty of the city. It portrays it as a place of splendor. It portrays it as a place of purity. It portrays it as a place of cost, something that is costly and valuable. It portrays it as a place that reflects God's glory. Notice the first stone is jasper. The stones are meant simply at one level and at a rather obvious level to just portray the beauty of the city and the splendor as the place where God dwells. It reflects God's glory. A second function of these 12 stones is, as well as some of the other stone imagery we saw a few verses earlier, and the gold, is that the stones clearly function to draw out further the contrast between Jerusalem and Babylon. That is, Babylon was a place which was described, Babylon prostitute back in chapter 17, verse 3, was described as being decked out in her garb, and that was gold and silver and all kinds of precious stones. Now you find the New Jerusalem decked out in stones and precious jewels and gold as well, to draw a stark contrast. This probably also contrasts with chapter 18 and verse 12, where gold and silver and precious stones were part of the cargo that Rome valued and imported. So the contrast then would be that what Rome exploited and perverted for its own use and its own selfish use, now the New Jerusalem represents, is now present in the New Jerusalem as a representation or as a reflection of God's glory. And to once more demonstrate, I think, that the New Jerusalem then compensates for anything that the people of God sacrificed for failure to participate in Rome's economy and failure to participate in Rome's luxury. By foregoing that, even to the point of suffering, remember the two churches, Smyrna and Philadelphia, that receive a positive evaluation are poor, and they are suffering at the hands of Rome. They're of no reputation. Now the jewels, I think, at one level here in the New Jerusalem, the same jewels that appeared in the Babylon prostitute vision now appear here to demonstrate that this far exceeds and compensates for anything that the saints sacrificed by refusing to participate in Roman luxury and refusing to participate in their idolatrous, godless practices and their commerce. A third association is one that we've already seen, and that is Isaiah chapter 54 and verses 11 and 12 portrayed the restoration of Jerusalem, a new Jerusalem. It doesn't use the word New Jerusalem, but it portrays the restoration, a new Jerusalem in the future, in terms of precious jewels, where it associated the different parts of Jerusalem, the gates, the foundations. It associated the foundations with a particular jewel. And so by portraying the New Jerusalem as made up of all these precious stones, it's another way of John suggesting this is the fulfillment of the end time restoration of the New Jerusalem expected in the Old Testament prophets. So stones would suggest end time eschatological restoration. A fourth function that I think is just as significant as the others is that these stones further highlight the city as a temple and the people of God as priests who serve in the temple. And that is because the stones here, I think, evidently represent the stone, 12 stones on the breastplate of the high priest. And so this, it continues the temple theme. It portrays the New Jerusalem as a temple, and it portrays God's people as priests. If you turn to Exodus chapter 28 and verses 15 through 21, you find a description of the breastplate that was to be worn by the high priest in the tabernacle, and each of the 12 stones were meant to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. Interestingly here, they represent the 12 apostles, not because the apostles have placed Israel, but because, again, the author wants to emphasize that it's not only Israel, but now all nations are included along with Israel, centered around Jesus Christ as the new people of God. So now the stones and the breastplate because they're associated with the foundation, we saw the foundation was associated with the apostles. So it's not suggesting the apostles and forget the tribes of Israel. It's the author wants to make clear that the church founded on the apostles in the New Testament is the church, which is a national, multicultural community made of people of every tribe and tongue and language. But Exodus 28 and the stones on the breastplate of the high priest ultimately lie behind this, the stones representing each of the 12 tribes and now representing the foundational member, the apostles of the Church of Jesus Christ, made of both Jew and Gentile into one new people of God. Notice also that according to this text, according to Exodus 28, the breastplate was in the shape of a square, which is the shape of the city itself. The New Jerusalem was already described as a square in John's vision. So the entire city is a temple, and God's people all function as priests who worship God. But I want to draw your attention to another interesting text that also links these stones, and this could be an additional feature. I'll treat it under the breastplate of the high priest, but this could be an additional meaning or an additional association of the stones. And back in Ezekiel chapter 28, in Ezekiel's oracles concerning Tyre, the city of Tyre that we've seen John utilize elsewhere to critique Rome's economy and its self-serving desire, commerce, and its lust for luxury and wealth. Now in verse, in chapter 28, and starting with, see which is the text I want, starting with verse 12. Actually, I'll start with verse 13. The author seems to be comparing Tyre to the situation in the fall of Adam in Genesis chapter 1 and 2 and 3 as well. Notice how he describes him. Verse 13, "You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you. Ruby, topaz, an emerald, chrysolite, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub, for so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones." So what I want you to notice is Adam is being portrayed here as a priest in the garden who wore the 12 stones on the breastplate of the high priest. Now, especially when you compare the Hebrew text and the Greek text, there's issues related to it's not certain exactly what all these stones are. The texts give you, I think, reasonable English translations of them, but I'm not interested in going into detail exactly what these stones were and what was the author envisioning as far as stones that people would have known of. I'm more interested in the overall associations, and what is intriguing here is the stones of the breastplate of the high priest are associated with Adam and the Garden of Eden. So, and since Ezekiel 27 and 28 has already played a role, as well as the entire book of Ezekiel providing a model for John's vision throughout Revelation, where he almost follows it in order, it's highly likely that John is not only drawing an Exodus 28, but also has Ezekiel 28 in mind as well, which then would associate the stones with both Adam and the Garden of Eden. In fact, other texts, especially apocalyptic texts, portray the Garden of Eden as a temple where God's glory, Adam functioned as a priest, and God's glory filled the garden. One interesting text, this is from another book with Enoch's name attached to it called Third Enoch, and This is 3rd Enoch chapter 5, starting in verse 1. From the day that the Holy One, blessed be He, banished the first man from the garden, the Shekinah resided on a cherub beneath the tree of life. The ministering angels used to muster and come down from heaven in companies and in bands and cohorts from heaven to execute His will in all the earth. The first man and his generation dwelt at the gate of the Garden of Eden so that they might gaze at the bright image of the Shekinah, or the brilliance of the Shekinah, which radiated from one end of the world to the other. I'll stop right there. But in this text and other texts, the Garden of Eden is portrayed as a temple where God's glory and His presence resides, just as it did in the tabernacle and the temple. And other texts make clear, I think, too, that Adam functioned as a priest. And certainly, Ezekiel 28 demonstrates the priestly associations of Adam, who wears the breastplate in the garden, and who wears the breastplate of the high priest, functioning as a priest in the Garden of Eden. In fact, interestingly, one book, if you're interested in reading it, it's called Pseudo-Philo, but I won't read from it. But in Pseudo-Philo, one tradition then has it that the stones on the breastplate were actually taken from the Garden of Eden, and then they are eventually placed in the ark until the end time, when they will be revealed. And so, once more, note the connection of the stones with the Garden of Eden, but also the eschatological implications, that they are hidden to be revealed in the future. Now the stones are finally revealed in John's vision. Another interesting text to draw your attention to outside of the Bible itself, one that we already drew attention to, and that is the commentary on Isaiah in the Dead Sea Scrolls from the Qumran community, one of the Qumran texts. And in one of the Isaiah commentaries, intriguingly, and we said in the Isaiah commentary on Isaiah 54, the author of that commentary from Qumran goes through the description of the restored Jerusalem, the gates and the walls and the foundations, and he equates the stones with founding members of the Qumran community, as if he sees in his community justification for the establishment of his community, a prophetic anticipation of that in Isaiah 54. And so what we saw was interesting is the author of the commentary on Isaiah 54 in the Qumran text equated the foundation and other stones with founding members of the community. Interestingly as well, one of the stones from Isaiah 54 and one of the groups is also associated with the Urim and Thummim, which were two stones on the breastplate of the high priest. And so you have an example in the Qumran text of taking Isaiah 54 and associating it with the stones on the breastplate of the high priest, which is exactly what John does. Isaiah 54 portrays the foundations of stones. That's the primary text John uses to portray the New Jerusalem in terms of stones. Now, in a similar move that the author of the Qumran text made, John now also, I'm not saying he read that, but doing something similar, now John also associates the stones on the breastplate with a feature of Isaiah 54. With the foundation stones from Isaiah 54. So then, the New Jerusalem is portrayed as a temple by associating it with the stones of the breastplate, which have been associated with Isaiah 54 and the stones that make up the New Jerusalem, which again, John has taken metaphorically to refer to the people themselves, so that ultimately he sees the New Jerusalem as the dwelling place of God, where God's people are priests that now worship and serve God in the new temple, Jerusalem, in the new creation. A fifth association, in addition to the temple imagery and also Garden of Eden imagery, is that we should understand these stones also, I think, as part of the adornment of the bride. That is, we should take these as part of the nuptial imagery that John is using to portray the people of God. We already saw back in chapter 21 and verse 2, John sees the New Jerusalem coming out of heaven adorned as a bride for her husband, drawing on Old Testament language. So now these jewels, these precious stones that make up the foundations, can also be seen as part of the bride's adornment, where now she is prepared as the bride in all her eschatological glory and presented to her husband, who is Jesus Christ. So I would suggest to you then that the stones have multiple associations, starting back with the simply representing the beauty of the city, glorious splendor of the city as a place that reflects God's glory. It contrasts with Babylon, Rome. It compensates for what they may have sacrificed at the hands of Babylon, Rome by refusing to participate. It suggests eschatological restoration in that the stones are associated with a rebuilt Jerusalem. The presence of the stones here suggests eschatological end-time restoration. It suggests the priestly nature of the people of God, the temple nature of the city as a dwelling place of God, where everyone wears now the breastplate of the high priest and they function as priests who serve and worship God. And along with that carries Garden of Eden and paradise associations. And then finally, it's part of the adornment of the bride. One other interesting feature, back to number 4, the priestly associations with the breastplate, it's interesting that right before and right after, in verse 18 and in verse 21, bracketing the description of the precious stones is a mention of gold as the makeup of the city, which once more is reflective of the description of the breastplate of the high priest back in Exodus 28 and elsewhere, where they're set in gold. And so perhaps another connection with the breastplate imagery. Now, one more feature of the city before we move on to look at its inhabitants, those who reside in it and who enter it, although already we're describing its inhabitants through the architectural features and makeup of the city, symbolically meant to portray the people of God. But one other feature is the street in verse 21. In most Greco-Roman cities, there would have been a main street or a thoroughfare that went down roughly down the center of the city, and that's usually where all the activity and commerce and things like that took place. That's probably what John has in mind here in reference to the street made of gold, and this is where we get the imagery of the street paved with gold, though we're probably not meant to take this with the literalness with which it's often treated, but again, gold being symbolic of this is the dwelling place of God, and a street being simply a common feature of any city for commerce and coming and going. This, however, may also, in addition to, or maybe as an alternative to the street, the word here may also suggest a wide place or a plaza that would have been in a typical Greco-Roman city. It's interesting that there seem to be a few other features in the New Jerusalem of Revelation 21 that reflect common conceptions in during the time leading up to and during the first century reflect common conceptions of an ideal Greco-Roman city. One of them was a street or thoroughfare that went through the city. Another one was the square shape and symmetry of the city. Was a feature of a Greco-Roman city. Another one was to have a good water supply, which you find in chapter 22, the river flowing out. So It's possible, too, that although John is primarily constructing his vision from Old Testament texts and even other Jewish apocalyptic texts, that at the same time, John is constructing a vision of a city that would also at the same time resemble the ideal Greco-Roman city. And that would stand to reason because all of his churches he's addressing in chapters 2 and 3 reside in Greco-Roman cities, in the provinces of Asia Minor, provinces of Rome. And so now it's as if John wants to say the true fulfillment of the ideal Greco-Roman city is not found in any city in Rome, but will only be realized in the New Jerusalem, anticipated in Old Testament prophetic text. And so John's New Jerusalem is the fulfillment of what the Old Testament anticipated, Old Testament prophets anticipated in a restored Jerusalem temple. But at the same time, it may be that John also sees it as the fulfillment of the ideals that people would have understood as belonging to an ideal Greco-Roman city. And now John's city, though, surpasses that. And John wants his readers and to find their hopes and aspirations not in any city that they belong to or Greco-Roman city, certainly not Rome, but only in the New Jerusalem of John's vision. Now, to move on then to verses 22 through 27, where we now are introduced to the inhabitants of the city. We've already noted that at one level, the stones and the city itself is the bride. So we've already been introduced to the inhabitants in terms of the people of God as the bride of the Lamb, now making up the New Jerusalem. But we're introduced to three other residences here. Two of them are obvious, and one of them is God himself. The other is the Lamb, and the third one is the nations. Now, first of all, verse 22 is a rather startling, at least for most people familiar with, for example, Ezekiel 40 through 48, most people familiar with apocalyptic texts, Jewish apocalyptic texts, would have been startled with verse 22, where John says, "I saw no temple." Now, it appears to me that although John doesn't seem to emphasize this, it's almost as if John, much like Ezekiel's vision, where he sort of moves inward in his measuring and vision of the temple, John is sort of moving inward. So I think one could almost see that now John is at the center of the city. He's inside the city, at the center of the city, and he says, "I saw no temple." That is, where you would expect to see a temple inside the city, whether it was a Greco-Roman city or restored Jerusalem, according to Ezekiel 40 through 48 and other Jewish apocalyptic texts, almost all Jewish apocalyptic texts include a temple is as part of the restoration of Jerusalem and the restoration of God's people. Now, in contrast to that, John says, "I didn't see a temple." Right where you'd expect him to see one, John says, "I saw no temple." And the reason is there's no need for one because now God and the Lamb are its temple. In other words, God and the Lamb dwell in the very midst of the people, making a physical temple, a separate physical temple, completely unnecessary. Now, at one level, it's incorrect to say there was no temple at all because the entire New Jerusalem is a temple. John has taken Ezekiel 40 through 47, the temple language, and applied it to the whole city. So in a sense, there is a temple, but the whole city's a temple. What John is saying is, within the city, there's no separate temple. Why? Because God and the Lamb are its temple. So the whole city, people, is a temple, but that's because God and the Lamb are the temple. God and the Lamb dwell in their midst. The reason for this is because the very thing that required a temple in the first place, throughout Israel's history, the very thing that required a temple is now gone. Sin and evil, as part of the first creation, sin and evil which barred direct contact between God and humanity, sin and evil, which made it impossible for God to dwell openly apart from a temple, has now been removed since starting in chapter 19 and 20, actually starting a little earlier, but with chapters 19 and 20 particularly, we have seen the removal of all sin and all evil in an extensive series of scenes of judgment. And now that everything has been removed, including the old creation, corrupted by evil and sin, and sin and evil have now been removed, now God can dwell directly with His people. So temple imagery is applied to the whole city, and that is because God and the Lamb are its temple. God and the Lamb dwell directly in the midst of His people without the need of a physical temple, because those things that required the temple in the first place, sin and evil in the first creation, have now all been removed. Now, because of that, because God and the Lamb are in the center of the city and are the temple, and their God's presence now is coextensive with the entire city and the entire new creation, now John can say there is no need of sun or moon. Why? Number one, because the precious stones they give off light, but more significantly, John tells us because God and the Lamb are its light. And probably we're to understand the lamp imagery as imagery from the temple. God and the Lamb are its, God is its light, the Lamb is its lamp. So that once more, this is a place, this is a temple, a sanctuary where God completely infused by God's presence. But now God's presence is not limited to a physical temple in one corner of the city. The entire city, New Jerusalem, and I would suggest the entire new creation, is now a holy temple where God dwells. John is drawing, I think, very clearly, almost as we've already noted too, that if you took away all the Old Testament allusions, you wouldn't have much left in this vision. But Isaiah has played a very crucial role. And it's interesting that Ezekiel has dominated in the first part of the vision, along with Isaiah 54, though. But now John is going to draw primarily on texts from Isaiah, especially 60 through 63. And then with chapter 22, John's going to return back to his Ezekiel model, Ezekiel chapter 47. But in chapter 60 and verse 19, John says, in chapter 60 in Isaiah is in the context of end-time restoration of God's people. Isaiah says, "The sun will no more be your light by day, nor will the brightness of the moon shine on you, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory." So Isaiah 60 provides the model here for John to say there's no need of sun or moon to shine in the new creation or to provide light, because God and the Lamb are now its light. And notice John adds the Lamb as also giving light. But this is a city so suffused with God's glory, His glorious splendor and His presence, that there is no need, in fulfillment of Isaiah 60, there's no need of the light. If you go back to the first three verses of Isaiah 60, "Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord rises upon you. See, darkness covers the earth, and thick darkness is over the peoples, but the Lord rises upon you, and His glory appears over you." I'll stop right there and read verse 3 in just a moment, because John also draws in verse 3. But the important point is to further demonstrate that this is a temple that where God's presence is now coextensive with the entire city, people, and indeed the entire New Jerusalem as a holy temple where God dwells. It's interesting that John goes on and describes in this vision as well that in verse 25, because, and notice how these build on each other. So first of all, that God and the Lamb fill the entire city, people, temple, and because they are in the temple, because they are the temple, there's no need of an additional temple, but also because they are a temple, because their glory of God fills the whole city, there's no more need of the sun or moon. Furthermore, verse 25, because of that, on no day will its gates ever be shut, for there will be no night. The reason seems to be rather obvious is that the shutting of the gates at night was to keep unwanted visitors or enemies out of the city. But now there will be no need for the gates to be shut because there's no night, because God's glory so fills the city. So another symbolic portrayal of the eternal security of God's people in the eschatological consummation. It's also kind of interesting, too, that you have a wall around the city, but there's no gates on it, or at least they're never shut. So it's almost as if the walls are unnecessary, but probably, we're not to make too literal a sense of this, but once more, I think the walls do indicate and symbolize, as part of a typical city, whether Jerusalem or any other first century city, the gates are simply part of the city, and they here symbolize the security of the people of God, and they're so secure that the gates can remain open without any fear of harm entering the gate or anything that would harm or defile the people of God. The light, then, that is the primary theme here. The light that comes from the glorious presence of God, the light, as you find elsewhere in the Old Testament, especially in association with God's presence, the light symbolizes here God's presence and His dwelling with His people. Yet, the light functions in another way, and that is, the light functions to attract the nations. Notice verse 24, the nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their splendor into it. Verse 26, the glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. These two verses are probably to be understood in terms of, the first one, verse 24, is it's the light that attracts the nations. It's the light that draws the nations. And then the fact that the doors are open in verse 25 not only indicate the security and there's no need to worry about unwanted visitors coming in, but the gates are also open because of verse 26, to receive the glory and honor of the nations. Now, the first thing to note, and I want to talk a little bit about this. The first thing to note is that John is heavily dependent once more on text right out of Isaiah. 24 seems especially to reflect Isaiah chapter 2, which right at the beginning of the book you have this vision or this a statement of end time salvation in Isaiah chapter 2. And starting of verse 2, in the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the nations. It will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. And this actually introduces an important theme throughout Isaiah, which is one of the reasons why John draws so heavily on Isaiah in this end time vision, because Isaiah portrays the inclusion of the nations in eschatological salvation, the drawing of the nations to come and worship God in Jerusalem. So, all the nations will stream to it. Many people will come and say, come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Israel. He will teach us His ways so that we may walk in His paths. The word of the Lord, the law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between nations and settle disputes. And I'll stop right there. But I want you to know this image of the nations streaming to the city to learn the ways of the Lord and to walk in its paths. Now John, in reflecting that text, says the nations will walk in its light. That imagery of walking, I think, coming right out of Isaiah 2. So what this is suggesting is the nations here are not just playing some subsidiary role, But the nations are actually coming to as part of the people of God. They are. This is a vision of the conversion of the nations to become part of God's people. We see the same theme later on in Isaiah chapter 60, in the text we just read that associates light with the New Jerusalem and God's light now filling the city. In chapter 60, and we read verses 1 and 2, but then starting with verse 3, after saying the darkness covers the earth, but the Lord will rise upon you, His glory appear over you, the glory of the Lord will now be their light. Now notice verse 3, nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. Also note verse 5, then you will look and be radiant. Your heart will throb and swell with joy. The wealth on the seas will be brought to you. To you the riches of the nations have come. Verse 6, herds of cattle will come to you, camels will come to your land. Young camels of Midian and Ephah and all from Sheba will come bearing gold and incense and proclaiming the praise of the Lord. And one last text, verse 11, your gates will always stand open. They will never be shut day or night, the text that John alludes to, so that men may bring the wealth of the nations, their kings led in triumphal procession. In other words, the light functions to attract the nations, and the open gates are to receive the influx of the nations, bringing in their wealth into the New Jerusalem, in fulfillment of Isaiah chapter 60 and Isaiah chapter 2 as well. Now, one of the questions that this text brings up to introduce to you is, who are these nations that now come into the New Jerusalem? It almost portrays them as being outside and now entering. Who are these nations, and how are we to understand them entering into the New Jerusalem? How are they outside and now they come in apparently? And the reason I raise this too is when you get to the end of chapter 20, there's nobody left. All the nations have been judged and destroyed, all of them. So I don't think we can necessarily conceive of this as, well, these are the survivors of that judgment. Maybe that's true, but Revelation isn't clear on that. Revelation simply says all the nations who have been gathered for battle, all the kings of the earth and all the nations, every last person, slave, free, whoever, have now perished at God's end time judgment. So at the end of verse 20, there's nobody left. All evil, all sin, all who have thrown in their lot with a beast, everyone has now been removed in a comprehensive final scene of judgment. So where do these nations come from? Who are they, and where do they come from, and how do they enter into the New Jerusalem? Let me make three or four comments that I hopefully will help us to sort through these issues. First of all, the inclusion of the nations here is added, I think, just because it's part of John's allusion to Isaiah 60. Part of the program of restoration in Isaiah is the inclusion of the nations. So John has been drawing on Isaiah, so the inclusion of the nations is going to be part of his allusion back to Isaiah 60 and the rest of the book of Isaiah. But we'll see there's more than that, because the inclusion of the nations, people from every tribe, language, tongue, and nation, has been a dominant theme of John's apocalypse all the way up until now. So it's got to be more than just allusion to Isaiah 60. But if John is following Isaiah's picture of restoration, end time restoration, it is natural that he would include the inclusion of the nations, especially since it fits his theme of people from every tribe and language and tongue. The second observation is the fact that they entered Jerusalem should not be taken too literally, as if they were outside of the new creation. After the new creation and the new Jerusalem has been established, now they're outside of it. Now we see that they finally get in it. But This language of entering into the New Jerusalem is probably just part of Isaiah's language. And John does not intend us to take it too literally, as if they're outside at some point. After the new creation has arrived, they're outside, and now they enter in. Probably the entering in takes place when the New Jerusalem comes down from heaven and everyone else enters into it and becomes part of it. But John's not interested in telling us when they get in or are they outside and they come in. We probably should not take that language with strict literalness, as if they're outside somewhere in the new creation and they enter in, or worse, some suggest these are the nations who have been punished in the lake of fire and now they're allowed to leave the lake of fire and they enter the New Jerusalem. No, John's just using the language from Isaiah. And doesn't, I don't think, mean for us to take it with strict geographical literalness. But he simply wants to allude back to Isaiah chapter 2, Isaiah chapter 60. Now, the question, though, that I want to deal with next is, but who are these nations and where do they come from? Especially since at the end of 20, all the nations have been judged. Apparently, there's no nations left. There's no kings of the earth, there's no nations, those who have opposed God's people, those the nations and kings of the earth, that's language of those who have been destroyed, those who have been deceived by the beast to associate with the beast and collude with the beast and commit adultery with the beast. That's who the kings of the earth and the nations are. And they've been judged and destroyed in chapter 19 and 20. And at the end of 20, there's apparently nobody left. So who are the nations and the kings that now are attracted to the light of the New Jerusalem, who now come through the open gates to bring their glory into it, to contribute their goods to it, to now come and walk in its light and worship God? In other words, apparently these are nations who have been converted and are now part of the eschatological people of God, and now enter the New Jerusalem. Who are they and where do they come from? In the next section, we'll spend a little bit of time trying to unravel that and try to propose a possible solution, possible way of looking at this feature of Revelation 21 and the New Jerusalem.
This is Dr. Dave Mathewson in his course on the Book of Revelation. This is lecture number 29, on Revelation chapter 21, the Bride, New Jerusalem, continued.